everybody. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and you're listening to the very last episode of 2022 for the Midnight Mass podcast. And I know what you're thinking. It can't be. No, say it isn't so. This is a disaster. Well, let me tell you this. We're going to speak all about disasters on this episode. But before we get into the main event, I have to introduce my fantastic co-host who knows a thing or two about the morning after pill. It is the one, the only, Michael Verratti.
There has to be a morning after, doesn't there, Peaches? No, it is true that this is our last episode of 22. That's because it's a New Year's special. The next time you hear from us, it will be 2023. It is not just our New Year's Eve special. It is not just the last episode of 2022. Did you know, Peaches, this is our 50th episode?
It's our 50th episode. And did you know, Michael, that in addition to this being our 50th episode, the epic cult movie classic that we have chosen to celebrate on none other than New Year's Eve is celebrating its 50th anniversary?
I did know that, and I'm glad, because we love a celebration here at Midnight Mass, so why don't we just get into it?
It's layers, layers upon layers here.
Yes, and layers that we have to climb through if we want to survive the night.
Right.
And with that inference, of course, I'm talking about 1972's The Poseidon Adventure, directed by Ronald Neame and starring truly the ensemble cast to end all ensemble casts that includes Gene Hackman, Shelley Winters, Leslie Nielsen, Roddy McDowall, Carol Lindley, Stella Stevens, Ernest Borgnine. I'm leaving people out because everybody's in this movie. Truly everybody. I'm sure if we get a time machine at some point, Peaches and I will be in this movie.
Did you say Gene Hackman?
I did. I started with him.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
Did you say Leslie Nielsen?
I did.
Clearly, I'm out to lunch.
I was going to say, listeners, now you have insight into how much Peaches pays attention. This movie's legacy cannot be denied. I mean, obviously, this was a big moment in Hollywood, but it is also a pivotal cult film because it in many ways instituted a whole subgenre of movies. Yes, the movie Airport came first, but it was with The Poseidon Adventure that we really minted the idea of the disaster epic that really took hold of the 70s. And many, many disaster movies have gone on to be cult films of their own. The Towering Inferno, the Airport sequels, Earthquake. But this movie is the movie that really set the mold. And I think it's just because it's such a brilliant piece of film and spectacle.
Well, I think you're right that it sort of sealed the deal for disaster films becoming a genre. Of course, there is Airport, which came in 1970, and then The Poseidon Adventure, 1972. And the other films that you mentioned are always the ones that are kind of lumped in with the disaster genre. But I think it's because they're the ones that followed most quickly, the Towering Inferno and what was the other? Earthquake.
Yeah.
But as you well know, we can then see that this is a genre that never did go out of style. Like throughout the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, we've seen, you know, disaster films in some form or another, Titanic is maybe one of the biggest movies, ever. And there, of course, was the Twister series. And, you know, they just never went out of vogue. I mean, this has really been something that started with these movies. And I would argue that of all the disaster films in the genre, including Titanic, that The Poseidon Adventure is the best of the bunch. At least for me, it is my favorite. I think it is one of the best movies ever made. I think it is just a great movie. It's just a fantastic fucking movie.
Well, I mean, as you know, I agreed because I had suggested that we do this for New Year's because the movie is set on New Year's Eve. While I was talking, I kept referring to it as both a Hollywood hit and a cult film. And it is a cult film because when you look at the way people have attached themselves to The Poseidon Adventure, it is in that cult spirit. You and I both know that there have been many unauthorized musical productions and cabaret performances and drag performances that have been inspired by the Poseidon Adventure. And I'm sorry, that just doesn't happen with Kramer versus Kramer. So that in of itself makes it a culty film.
That's right.
What I think is most fascinating about this particular movie in the Midnight Mass canon is you and I have covered many horror films that have included very gratuitous and violent and scary moments. And yet, I do not think that we have discussed a movie more harrowing than The Poseidon Adventure. This movie stresses me the fuck out.
It really captures a sort of realism in this situation that I think a lot of disaster films don't. There are some horror movies that I think do it really well. I think The Descent does it very well, where you really feel the stress of the situation. But most don't. You know, I think it's a really hard thing to capture. And I do think it's a combination of great filmmaking, great directing, but really like the performances have to be dialed in. And especially in a movie like this, where it is truly an ensemble piece. The fact that they're all working together so well to communicate, well, both their characters working together to get through this situation, but also the actors in terms of the way they're feeding off of each other's stress, the comedy of it, the pathology of it all, the looking at your final moments, perhaps. And it's, oh my God, it's just so great. It's such a great movie. I could go on and on. And it is one of those movies, like something like, you know, I don't know, The Silence of the Lambs, where it is a bona fide cult movie that also happens to have been well received. You know, we often talk about movies that come out that weren't well received when they were released. But The Poseidon Adventure, people definitely knew this was a great movie. Shelley Winters was, of course, nominated for an Academy Award. In fact, there were a few nominations for Academy Awards. The only thing that won, because I went and looked it up, was the song, The Morning After, which won for Best Song. But there were a bunch of nominations. And then, of course, they won awards in other places. So it is one of those movies that came out and the world knew it was a good movie, like Silence of the Lambs or The Exorcist or some of these other films that we talk about. I like mentioning that because we often talk about films, mostly we talk about films that were misunderstood when they came out and, you know, people didn't like them. But this is one of those movies that has endured because of its cult and because of people's extraordinary attachments to it. And the very first Star Search competition, I hosted a show called Star Search back at the Shack at Stud. That went on for over 20 years, where it was a search for new drag talent. And it was one of the later ones, because I remember the first one was won by Ursula Andrade. But this was maybe the second or third. And Tweeka Turner was this queen who came out, and she did The Morning After. And she had all of the stage kind of turned upside down, including a Christmas tree that she was hanging from at the end of the number, singing, you know. And she won because she was a disaster. The number was a disaster, but it was also beautiful. It was a beautiful disaster. It was perfect. And she looked, you know, like she came out looking glamorous. And by the end of the number, she looked like a total wreck. And it really captured the essence of this movie. So there is this thing with this film that I just love, where it has spoken to so many of us generationally in this way that has made it cult, where we keep revisiting it. We keep watching it. We want to see it over and over.
Right.
Much like our Christmas special, Black Christmas, being a movie that I think you could really watch every year, make it an annual tradition for Christmas. I think this is the perfect New Year's film to watch annually.
I agree. And, you know, we make a lot of the power of the ensemble in our interview with our guests this week. But what you're talking about, this encapsulation of style and an execution that this movie has, it's the whole movie. In rewatching it, in anticipation for this conversation, I clued into the fact that the camera is always moving, which is really unique. You know, the idea that even if it's a stationary shot, the camera tilts back and forth before the disaster to remind you they're at sea. Mm-hmm. The fact that the set pieces, which surely had to be built because they had to build everything upside down, are grand and big and intimidating to sell the idea of how small and how in danger these people are. Everything about this movie, for the time that it was made, seems impossible. Like, I mean, this is a big, big movie. To make the Poseidon Adventure today would be millions and millions of dollars. And as we know, they tried to do it and it didn't quite work the way it did back then.
You mentioned our guest, and you did say singular guest. And so this is one of our episodes, which tend to be more unique. We typically have a couple guests on, but once in a while, we have a singular guest. And that's often because the guest really has plenty to say and is so well connected to a film, and their passion for a particular film is so intense that we actually decide to dedicate two interviews times worth discussing the film with them. And this guest is not only someone who we have thought about having on the show for multiple films, because they are one of those unique people who, like us, has kind of been so inspired by cult movies that they've dedicated a chunk of their creative expression to celebrating cult movies. And I think she is one of the most interesting people when it comes to cult movies and how they have inspired her performance.
But when I reached out to her about this particular movie, what she told me and what she explains across the course of her interview is that that adoption of cult film, in the case of the Poseidon Adventure specifically, goes even deeper because she has made it part of her DNA. You know her as the dancing diva of drag, Love Connie, and we're talking to her about the Poseidon Adventure right now. Welcome back, listeners. We're excited to be joined here on the boat by our next guest. An iconic and definitive dancing diva, you've no doubt seen her dazzling guest appearances on RuPaul's Drag Race. Known for high-kicking, high-energy stage shows such as Connie Loves Juice, Fade to Connie, and her recent I'll Be Ho for Christmas. She's also appeared in music videos and shorts from such queer luminaries as Big Dipper and Alaska Thunderfuck 5000. Her alter ego, John Cantwell, is no stranger to the spotlight either, having appeared in such iconic movies as Legally Blonde and Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. More than just a choreographed cult sensation, I know her to be a true connoisseur of 70s cinema, which of course makes her perfect for today's movie. Please welcome star of stage, screen, and much, much more. It's Love Connie. Hi, woo-hoo! Connie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody. I feel like Jennifer Lopez. That introduction was wild.
You're like old. You're the EGOT of drag queens.
Right. The goat. The cow.
Well, hello. That's my role. So, Connie, I have to ask, where did it all begin? Because, you know, I know that before we started recording, we started to get into it a little bit. I think we should start there. What are your earliest memories of the Poseidon Adventure? And why do you think that it became so important to you?
Well, I think my love of movies, or cinema, as I call it now, began early. And I grew up in the northeast region of Louisiana called the Mississippi Delta. If y'all want a good music reference, like Bobby Gentry, Billy Joe McCann, you know, all that good stuff. You know, all those bridges, you know, he jumped off the Tallahassee Bridge. Well, I live near the Mississippi River Bridge. And in order to get to the, it was called the Battlefield Twin Cinema, Vicksburg, Mississippi, you know, yes, the Civil interesting, topical. We would have to cross the Mississippi River Bridge, which it was really wide and it was really scary back then. And I remember going to the movie, and some of my earliest childhood memory of cinema is the Poseidon Adventure. And that's just a testament, because I was born in 1967 in December, and I know the film came out in 72. Was it 72? And I don't know what, if it was fall, but I was probably 4 years old. Back then in the 70s, you never knew if you were seeing a re-release or a second run of the film. But that and Blazing Saddles and the Dirty Harry movies were the ones that I remember being held and sitting on my parents' lap. But The Poseidon Adventure, I really was obsessed with that movie as a small child, and I somehow saw it several times. So I don't know how many times it ran or reran in the theater or when it came on TV, but I seem to have seen it a lot because I remembered a lot about it when I was a kid before VHS and buying it, you know what I mean? And then, or HBO seeing it repetitively.
It's interesting because your core memory of this is going to the theater and seeing it. And that's a great way, of course, to experience a movie like The Poseidon Adventure because it's a whole lot of movie. It is a big movie. And when I reached out to you about this film, you mentioned that it was one of your first theater experiences. And then you said something that I found particularly fascinating, which was the five female leads of this movie to you are your five favorite female characters in the whole of cinema. And could you talk about that?
That kind of came to me not that long ago. And now with the whole gender identity and that being in the forefront of conversation now, and even the Me Too movement, you know, and I thought being locked down in the pandemic where you're just, I was alone, you know, so I was just, woo, what's going on? And then you do remember things like, oh my God, I was raped by this guy. You know, I remember. And then you start, and then I realized, as an actor, as long as I've been doing this, I don't identify with male characters in film. And I know I'm not the only one. I did try to think of, is there a male character that I do identify with in film? And the only one that I could come up with is Jeffrey Beaumont in Blue Velvet, because I'm always fascinated by who lives in that spooky building. And I think that's why I like De Palma and Robert Altman, because they have very voyeuristic sometimes approaches, you know, just this kind of mystery. And being from a small town too, and that isolation, you know, and knowing you're gay or that you know you're attracted to the same sex, it just, you know, causes you to, you know, be silent and cerebral. But those characters, and I think as gay men, and I can tell you about each of them and how I believe as gay men, and even today, and especially like I say with doing Love Connie really is all of those women, because Shelley Winters, hey, I always think I'm the fattest person in the room. I'm not. That's just, again, when you're raised by an overly critical Southern mother who wanted everything perfect, you know, you tend to be self-conscious, you know, but you're like, I know I'm better. I'm not just fat in the water. I'm a very skinny lady, you know, at the end of the day. But again, when you go back and you think, but you were only four, I'm just going, nope. If it's all predestined, if, you know, when we think about what are your beliefs in the world, I'm saying this was my Bible and my religious moment at that early age to give me an impression. On a side note, I was also thinking about this because I don't know if you can see there's a wig head up there. When I would go visit my mama and papa in the country, I would always go into their bedroom and I would open the closet and I would look up, and on the top shelf were these three wig heads with the exact same wig on it. And then I would just shut the door. But I had to go look at them like, so that, and now The Poseidon Adventure, this was all happening at the same time. The other thing, like the Pamela Sue Martin character, I really love her character also, because I always had crushes on older men and like daddies. And I think as gay men, when we are estranged from, or, you know, like I was closer to my mom, and you know what I mean? And my dad was distant. So there's that kind of desire that I feel from that Pamela Sue Martin character. And I also love when she freaks out at the end when Gene Hackman drops and she's just like, it's like the Donna Wilkes in Jaws 2. It's literally like, it's like, oh, you know, yeah, feel it. And Nani, Carol Lindley, just, I mean, come on. Debbie Harry is my all-time greatest inspiration. Olivia Newton-John, who doesn't want to be the pretty, there's got to be more, you know, it's just beautiful. And then my favorite, just the one that even at a very young age, I just said, oh, I'm that woman. And also because I believe that my mom had that same tone as Stella Stevens, that Linda Rogo. And I remember being really entertained by that first introduction to her and Dummy Rogo. That's what they called him, yeah. Rogo, right? Where she's sick and the nurse is in there. And I remember it was something because I grew up around a lot of ass jokes and ass. I think of my favorite aunt at this time of year, because she used to always tell me, she goes, "What are you getting for Christmas?" And I would tell her, and then she would go, "Well, I'm asking Santa Claus for a new butt. Do you know why?" And I go, "Why?" And she goes, "Because this one has a hole in it." So when they say the line about the suppositories, and Ernest Borgnine goes, "Suppositories? What is she supposed to do with those?" And Stella goes, "I know what to do with them." She and Ernest Borgnine looked like my parents, you know, kind of. My dad was a big beer drinker and loved sports, loved to coach baseball. So he was kind of outdoorsy and gruff. And my mother was together, but she could have loosened up and been a little more Linda Rogo, because I think she had a tiger. Obviously, the tiger, I'm the tiger. So I'm doing what she couldn't do, I guess. But yeah, I love those women. And it wasn't until I saw Jackie Brown, because I thought about Jackie Brown came out in 1997. And that was a kind of an important time. I had just moved or was transitioning from New York to LA. And I had a lot of credit card, you know, that thing when you're 30 and you've like, oh my God, now I'm having to deal with like a lot of debt. And you also, as a gay performer, you're also trying to create something for yourself when you're not able to book other jobs because you're a little more effeminate. You know, with me, a lot of mine was my Southern accent that took going to New York to drop. So it became a bit of a struggle. So when I saw Jackie Brown and I saw the struggle that Pam Grier's character, and not just Pam Grier, but Bridget Fonda's and the woman that plays Simone, who lip syncs Baby Love for Robert De Niro, I'm going, I identify with her. Even Sharonda, the crackhead on the sofa, I'm going, I smoke way too much pot. You could tell me we were in Hollywood and we could be in Inglewood and I might not know. Then I said, oh, wow, the Poseidon Adventure, those were the female characters in film that I needed for that whole first 30 years of my life, because the message of the Poseidon Adventure is also biblical. I grew up in the church, Southern Baptist, and you know, all that crazy stuff. And I even went to a Southern Baptist college and was a minister of music for a very short time. Oh, it was crazy. I had a little country church. So there's a lot of that, you know, that rural countryness. I always say, Connie, it comes out, you know, when she gets mad, or you know what I mean, which I think is that real hillbilly comedy. It's also funny to watch when you watch reruns of Charlie's Angels. It's very funny to listen to Jacqueline Smith when she has to scream or yell at a bad guy, because the full-on Texas comes out. She gets real country.
Yeah, I never put two and two together about that. I, for many years, tried to get rid of my Maryland accent, which I don't really have anymore. Although, whenever I say the word on, people go, what? And I'm like, you know, I'm on it, you know. So there's a few words. However, when I used to drink, or if I'm really tired, it's not so much if I'm angry. Then, if I'm very sleepy, then people go, where are you from? I never noticed you talking like that before. I don't yell that often, but I do wonder. I'm like, huh, I wonder if I yell, but if my accent will come out. But like, that whole thing, like your idolatry of the women of the Poseidon Adventure, I think is specifically of interest to this podcast, because this is a cult movie through and through. And it's a cult movie that casts a wide net. I mean, it is technically, it's a disaster film. But I think for a lot of us queer people who grow up worshiping the Poseidon Adventure, yes, I love disaster films. I love The Towering Inferno. I love Airport. But this movie is something different. There's a heart to it. And you're tapping into the preacher part, which I want to go back to. That Gene Hackman performance is, one, probably I think his best. And also, it's just so lovely. And I also grew up as part Catholic, very, very Catholic. But my father was Southern Baptist. So you're triggering all this stuff in me where I'm going, oh, yeah, like that's a thing. The Gene Hackman thing kind of represents, in a way, an idealized version of something that I yearned for as a kid.
Well, he says that really important line, because, you know, he has the older priest. I think it's Jack Albertson that plays that. And he goes, We need to stop praying to a God up there in the sky and start praying to that part of God within us to get us through. And that's the whole set. And when I was a kid, that was the boring part of the movie for me. I was more fascinated with the water, you know, and that was where I was going with the Mississippi River. So just that whole thing of like, and we would vacation on the, you know, Redneck Riviera. So Jaws, come on, water. So that's another reason why I love it, is because you're also in the middle of water, and the idea of that wave, and then you, not just that, you've now fucking flipped upside down, and now it's like, how are we even going to walk on? But then it's like, you got to get into the God that's inside you if you want to. And any performer, actor, almost everyone can relate. Even if you were like a rich person, you could be like, oh my God, what if that was my boat? Anyone can like watch that movie and just go, this is a knife to the fucking heart, man. It does make you think. It's like, are you going to be one of those that just sits there? And it's like, you know, or would you go up? Because that's scary. But yeah, Gene Hackman is so powerful. I think a lot of us would be like, no, I would go with a sexy preacher. You know what I mean? I mean, come on. Why would you not go with a strong man that believes in God? I'd be like, I'm sorry, I don't care what you believe, I'm going with him because he believes it. You know what I mean? So I'm with him.
It's really interesting because when you were talking about the five women of this movie and how they sort of set the mold for what Connie became and that got you through a chapter of life, and then you inferred that the women in Jackie Brown kind of led to another chapter. You also said something that I really connected to, because I think on a show called Midnight Mass that worships the language that we use, cult movies, you said something that's very applicable to what we talk about every week, because you mentioned that The Poseidon Adventure in many ways is your Bible. You talked about when you were a kid, you liked the water, the kind of spectacle of it, what we would expect of a blockbuster. You go and you see the big set pieces and the harrowing things, but then you're also speaking to growing with the movie. And as you look back on it, looking at these different characters and what they mean to you, do you suppose that part of the resonance of the movie is that you can look at it over the years and gain something new each time you watch it?
I happen to have horrible comprehension. I have self-diagnosed myself. I am probably ADHD. I probably have a lot wrong with me. But we're from Louisiana and we don't go to doctors. We're not talking to therapists. We're not going to AA. That's why Brittany is so enjoyable on Instagram. But like, oh my God, just get it out, girl. Because, you know, it is what it is. What was your question, dear?
You talked about how when you were a kid, you liked the water, but then you've internalized the idea in the last few years that these five women really informed you as a person and informed Connie as a character. And that was what I was just asking about, is what you were saying, the idea that like you gain something from it every time you watch it as you grow with it.
Yeah, my comprehension is bad. So yeah, I'm kind of bad with that. The reason it also stuck with me is because it had the casting. Another thing that's interesting about the women that absolutely did not work in any of those sequels. But when people get wet, it's hard to tell. Like all the women had the same hair in the sequel. So when they all got wet, it was like a bunch of dark haired, you know, people in the dark. And I couldn't in the Poseidon Adventure, everyone's filthy, but you know who they are. Stella's got the crazy blonde curls and she's in the shirt. Shelley's in the gray. Pamela Sue in those hot pants. And then how it gets dirtier and dirtier, which is parallel to Carrie. I always love what Jackie Beat says about Poseidon Adventure and Carrie. It's like the greatest movies where everyone shows up looking their best to party. And then by the end of the movie, they all look like absolute shit and death, you know? I think it was just those visuals. I was also fascinated with amusement parks because, like I say, childhood, you always remember summer vacation. And it was always in Panama City Beach, Florida in the 70s, you know, cheap family motels. And we would always see the summer blockbuster. So that's where I would have seen Jaws, you know, and that was wild to see Jaws on summer vacation when you're in the second grade, you know, and like how powerful that was. So yeah, that spectacle of that, I don't even like special effects today because I love the special effects in the Poseidon Adventure and the Exorcist and everything that's an applied, even Superman. I was watching, you know, some stuff with them flying, you know, and I really do love that. I love that piano. I was also, I don't want to say fascinated, but Helter Skelter was also really popular at that time because the trial was happening. And I think I was also starting to learn about death and just kind of like, oh, death can happen at any time. It could be people breaking into your house and going apeshit crazy on you with knives, or we could be having a party and a siren goes off and all of a sudden our shit is flipped upside down.
When we do Midnight Mass, of course, when we talk to uber fans of cult movies, we get into people's favorite lines and their favorite scenes. And we've talked about your favorite characters and the inspiration you get from the female leads, of course. But when I think about the Poseidon Adventure, the thing that I remember the most from the time I saw it when I was a kid, and I sort of connect this with female trouble of all things, is the Christmas tree. Because I grew up in a family where my mother was Joan Crawford when it came to our Christmas tree. She would, I mean, my fucking mom would let us as the kids decorate the tree. I will never forget this. We would spend all day decorating the tree. We would put our little homemade ornaments in the front, you know, where everyone would see them. We would, you know, do it all. We'd go to bed that night. We'd come down the next day. The whole tree was totally redecorated. All of our homemade ornaments were put on the back where you couldn't see them. You know, my mom was crazy when it came to her tree. And then she would deny that she had done that. She has since admitted it, you know, as because as adult children, we've been like, bitch, we were wise to your freakish behavior around your tree. But the tree was like this sacred thing, you know? So when Divine throws that tree on her mother, you know, I just remember, like, for me, the first time I saw the movie, it was like, oh my God. And same thing with Poseidon Adventure, the Christmas tree, the way the Christmas tree is used in this film.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, do you have favorite scenes?
Well, you know, what's funny about that Christmas tree scene is it took me years. It wasn't until I was an adult that I even got the line, I promise Mrs. Rosen, no more Christmas trees or something like that. I, as a kid, for some reason, I always thought that Shelley Winters was responsible for bringing that. Now, again, I didn't get the Jewish thing and that would never happen. I also love the fact that the boat's already flipped upside down. You know, the dude's landed, done the fall, and everyone's kind of getting up. And then the fucking tree has been kind of there upside down as if it's on its tip. And then it falls, and that's the other, like, shit, y'all. You know, like, we really are going to have to get out of here because this place is a nightmare. I also love just when they're climbing the tree and you think, because we had magnolia trees down south. So I was forever climbing up the, you know, playing Poseidon Adventure, climbing up the interior of the magnolia tree. And then you would get right at the top and be like, argh! You know what I mean? And then, again, there's so many ass jokes in the movie. And again, my dad was very Archie Bunker, Fred Sanford, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. You know, so that shot of her ass, and then he pushes her, and then Shelley does that real Shelley moment. Again, she's bringing you the comedy in the horror film. You know what I mean? Just
yeah.
At the right, she's just playing it so real, and she's so wonderful. I just love that shot. And you see her
dive into the water, yeah.
And she's big compared to everyone who, you know, those women are just tiny little wisps of skeletons. You know, the one scene I love is when the water is first rising. And I love the whole thing, if you notice, because they all have to go in lines. You know what I mean? And at that point, Stella is at the very end of the line. And when she turns around and you see that, it's a creepy scene to me because, again, everything's upside down. So you're like, where is this? Where is this? Where are we? But you see that water rise up into that little door, and Stella Stevens is like, oh my God, we gotta get up here. And they're trying to get Belle. Oh, look, I just got chills. They're trying to get Belle up. They've got Belle with the fire hose strapped around her, and she's in those. You ever look at Shelley's heels that she's wearing? You know what I mean? Because they all keep their heels on, which is another thing that, you know, I can't stand when, now granted, I wear sensible heels because I really don't want to break my leg, and I'm kind of a clumsy dancer. But I don't like when drag queens take their shoes off, you know, to do so, because I'm like, hey, the girls in the Poseidon Adventure never took their platforms off. Could have broken an ankle. God, when she said the line, "I'm going next, in case old fat ass gets stuck, I won't be behind her." And, you know, she's climbing into the tunnel. I've got the camera. And I just remember knowing when to laugh and loving everybody in the theater just cracking up. It's such a great character that, because when you think about Church and how you'd be like, she's the outcast, you know. Again, she's one of those characters that you're like, I'm picking you. I'm going to go with her. Yeah, yeah. We got the preacher. Get the Mary Magdalene, you know, you got to get her in there, because it is kind of, you know, if Gene Hackman is Jesus and he's the sacrifice, it's, you know, the ultimate, I got you through to, I don't know what, salvation, life after death, if we were all supposed to die, if it's final destination. And then, you know, she would be the Mary Magdalene, because she does, it's like they get it to the very end and you don't think, oh no, once Shelley dies, no. And then they have to kill her. And they say in the book, she's a real cunt. Like, they say her character is not likable at all. And that she was supposed to fall off and then get skewered onto something and kind of writhe in pain and then die. So I think that's also because, you know, I'm a blonde lover. I Debbie Harry, Olivia Newton-John, you know, Sharon Tate, you know, she was the first. I had to look at that book every Saturday before going to a matinee, the Helter Skelter book. I don't know why, but just she was so beautiful. And they had that one really beautiful shot of Sharon Tate. And I remember just thinking, why would someone want to kill her? She's so beautiful and she just looks so nice. So then seeing, you know, at a young age, Stella Stevens is just wonderful blonde, you know, just bosomy and sexy and loud and brash. It just, oh, it just devastates me to when she dies.
I think you raise a really good point that we, none of us have addressed up until this moment, that this is based on a book. And the fact that Stella Stevens' character, it has a slightly different fate in the book. I think the movie takes a lot of different turns from what I know about the book. I know the kid does not survive in the book. He just goes off to the bathroom and never comes back. For deep cut Poseidon Adventure fans, maybe it's time to go do some reading. Now, Connie, as we're wrapping up, I know that you incorporate a lot of your cinematic loves into your work. I have seen many of your shows. I have seen Debbie Harry. I have seen De Palma. I've seen you bring that in. And maybe I'm just forgetting, or maybe I missed this one. Have you ever put Poseidon Adventure into one of your shows, or how would you do that?
There was at one moment when I was doing my Roxy Music show, and we were trying to figure out what to do with Love is the Drug. And it was just like a mind block when I finally figured it out. It's the Michelle Pfeiffer trio, but we left out Fabulous Baker Boys. I'm like, I have to end Love is the Drug on top of a piano. But then it's like, how do we get a miniature piano in the Cavern Club? So I do kind of go crazy with things. But originally, I was trying to think of it as Love is the Drug, like me, Love, Connie is the drug. And I wanted to try and get every tiny dance sequence of any random film all put together. And I wanted to kind of dance with everybody and mimic them. Because I've always loved when Pamela Sue Martin walks onto the dance floor. She's just so cool. And she's got that shag haircut. And I really wanted to do that. But I couldn't think of enough films to fit into Love is the Drug. So one day.
I'm surprised that you haven't done, you know, some sort of version of The Morning After, which it is one of those songs that's like, it's so bizarre when you take it out of the you know, like when you think of that movie and the disaster and the size of the movie, but that song is so beautiful and so sweet and so lovely. And, you know, I have to say, I didn't know until we were preparing for the podcast and I'm like, you know, reading different websites and stuff. I didn't realize that it wasn't actually sung by Carol Lynley in the movie.
It sounds like what she would sound like.
Yes. So the woman that sings it in the movie is Renee Armand. And then the release that came out, like the radio play version, was Maureen McGovern. So it's just this interesting, very iconic song. But the other thing I wanted to mention, which I totally could see being part of a Love Connie show, is the John Williams score. I mean, this is early John Williams, and he shows you, like, this is what I can do. Yeah, it's epic.
Because that opening scene when it's raining, if you think it's like, this is going to be a wonderful experience of life and cinema and everything.
Yeah.
Really, my whole character of Connie is those four girls, because if you put me in with a romantic lead like Mario and in Connie Loves Juice, I'm total Pamela Sue Martin. But the minute there's a threat, I will turn into Stella Stevens on a dime. My look, I would say, is Carol Lindley, because it's just that kind of like Daisy Duke casual. Yeah. I liked her casual sexiness and her casual loveliness, you know, because if you look at Carol Lindley films up until Poseidon Adventure, Bunny Lake, you know, the first one is a masterpiece because, you know, it's premature and everything and it's black and white. But then they kind of didn't really know what to put her in. And because, like, even she did, there's a movie called Once You Kiss a Stranger. She did, it's a remake of Strangers on a Train. She murders someone with a golf cart. And it's just kind of like, so I think that character is probably really Carol Lindley. And also, that's the character that has the least fight in her, which I identify as Connie. Like, it doesn't always end so happy. It's kind of happy, but there's something just sad about it. And there is such a sadness in Carol Lindley's character. I did think it was weird that she loved her brother so much, but I guess when he's your brother and he's the drummer of your band, you know, there's just a real tight bond there. So there were some local LA productions of Poseidon Adventure that were genius, where you're thinking, how are they going to show water rising on stage? And they had all these dancers dressed as water. I think they did a Towering Inferno too, where the dancers were all fire. And I just would be just putting it out big, like, oh my God, someone call me, please. Any I would do it. There's still a couple of characters we could age into.
Right.
I was going to say, if you're out there mounting a live production of Poseidon Adventure, Connie has put you on notice. Connie, I love that we ended this conversation where in a kind of full circle moment where you explain how the women of the Poseidon Adventure together make up the whole of your character, because I think that that is truly what cult fandom is. We take these things and we embrace them. So yes, you were the ultimate Poseidon guest in that way. What are you up to next? Where can people find you? How can people see your next show? What's going on?
Speaking of soundtracks and film soundtracks, I have been doing the last Sunday of every month at Akbar, which is a local bar at Sunset and Fountain. Yes, they do intersect. In Silver Lake, called Soundtrack Sunday. It's just been super fun. I take a different film soundtrack and kind of create a show around it as a side one intermission, side two thing. And it lasts about an hour and I get some local performers and we do that. And it's super, super fun. So
if you're a listener of the Midnight Mass podcast and you are unaware, shockingly, of Love Connie at this point, please, you got to go and see her shows. You got to go support this queen because her show is a cult movie. You know, it's inspired. Yes. It is all the stuff that we love. So, you know, we're thrilled that you could be on for the Poseidon Adventure. It was meant to be.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And that was our interview with the fantastic Love Connie. Obviously, I love, love, love how she describes how her character is the embodiment of the women from Poseidon Adventure, because that to me is essential Midnight Mass stuff. The idea that we take these cult films and we carry them with us. You know, I frequently ask guests about how their relationship with these movies has changed, but when you take the characters of a film and you mold that DNA into your being, you are sort of the embodiment of the film going forward.
Well, for me, as someone who often talks about the characters or the inspirations that made up becoming Peaches Christ, and I always think of it as a sort of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit for me. You know, I've got Divine, I've got Freddy Krueger, and I've got Elvira, you know, in there, you know, give or take. But with Love, Connie, it was such a great revelation because I didn't know that going into today's conversation with her. I didn't realize how completely seminal this movie was to the creation of this character that we love so much. But as she discussed it and she went through the archetypes of the women that are presented in the Poseidon Adventure, it was both fascinating and also just so, I don't know, such a great celebration. It was such a great way to kind of dig into this movie and to realize like the attachment she has to this film is almost spiritual. We can have these relationships with movies where we're not just fans of these films. These films have defined who we become.
Yeah, I love it so much. Now, of course, in discussing the Poseidon Adventure, as we got into with Connie, you have to take note of this amazing ensemble. And she spoke to how important a certain group of those characters were to her. But something you and I haven't been able to get into yet is what these characters mean to us. Do you have a favorite member of the Poseidon Ensemble, Peaches?
There's going to be no surprise here that Shelley Winters is Belle Rosen. Is, you know, my favorite character. If you are a Patreon subscriber, then you'll know that one of the sort of advent calendar Christmas suggestions I made towards the end of the advent calendar was revealed to be Who Slew Auntie Rue. You know, Shelley Winters to me is a queer icon. Yeah. You know, she's the unexpected movie star would show up on screen and just command attention. And she had one of those incredible careers. I mean, she ended up being on Roseanne, you know. And to me, if you were going to ask me, like, what is the pinnacle Shelley Winters performance, it's her in the Poseidon Adventure.
Which is so interesting, too, when you think of Shelley Winters, because, of course, she would be my selection as well. It's undeniable. I think if you're a certain kind of cult film fan, you just love her.
And we're gay.
Yeah, of course. But when you think of Shelley Winters, she has certainly played more over the top, more campy, more draggy, more overstated characters. But I think it is the emotional maturity and simplicity of this character, the fact that she sheds the camp for a pure human expression in this movie, that makes her so powerful. Of course, we get the camp in the form of Stella Stevens, and she's fucking amazing too, like no question. This whole cast is great. They all deliver. Yeah. But there are these like really, really powerful moments. And Connie points out when everyone's ignoring Mrs. Rosen, and then she dives into the water, that moment where Shelley Winters poses and jumps in. That's such a cinematic moment that despite this disaster, this amazing ensemble, this huge set, all eyes are on her in that moment. And I think that's power. You know, it is interesting too, talking about that character, is how many, and I would be interested for the younger audience who kind of bristles at things that you and I don't, because we talk about the subversive nature of cult films. But upon rewatching this movie, it was harder to ignore how many fat jokes they make at her expense over the course of this film.
That's right. It is both sort of surprising when you rewatch it now, because I don't know that we would do that. I think part of the strength of it is just loving how Shelley Winters, I guess that's part of drag, right? Like she really does embrace it and make it something that she owns. She's not the butt of those jokes in this film. And you see that with the way that she kind of turns it on its head. I wanted to mention that we do talk a lot about the women of the film. While, as you know, I too am attracted almost always to the strong female leads of any film, any cult film. But there is something so spectacular, I think, about Gene Hackman in this film that is undeniably great. And I just wanted to acknowledge that, you know, this is an actor who is one of these people that I will be honest, I kind of forget about, you know, and then something like, you know, Superman will come on, or I don't know, just some movie where I forget that he's in it. And I'm like, oh God, you know, what a great actor. He's so good. Poseidon Adventure, I just think he's just incredible. And I can't imagine the movie with another actor playing that part.
I mean, I think that his performance in this is next level. And of course, you and I, as the oft sacrilegious people that we are attracted to him, because where else in cinema history are you going to get Gene Hackman yelling at God? I mean, like, this is it. This movie takes you there. His performance is great. And you're right. We do almost exclusively celebrate the women in this episode, but this whole ensemble is great. I think Ernest Borgnine sort of is the foil to Gene Hackman's character is a hell of a performance. You know, he was a celebrated actor for a reason. And even just, I love Roddy McDowall anytime he pops up in anything. And he's so...
You forget that Roddy McDowall is in this.
And, and he's so wonderful with that sort of fey calmness that he brings to everything, you know?
Yeah.
I think that this movie was one of those movies that fires on all cylinders, even when the cylinders on the Poseidon were not working.
The other thing I think that it's fun to acknowledge is sort of how these people, we talked about Shelley Winters, but how, you know, someone like Gene Hackman, you know, not only is he in the Superman series, but shows up in something like The Birdcage, like how these people who go all the way back to a movie that came out in 1972, you know, kind of have been with us through so many of these, you know, incredible movies and made an imprint over and over again. And of course, Roddy McDowall ends up showing up later in life in some of our favorite movies. So it's one of those movies where it is epic in every way. The cast is epic. The music is epic. The way it's shot is epic. The concept is epic. This ship being turned upside down. In my show, Legally Black, which of course is a parody of Legally Blonde, there is an entire number dedicated to the bend and snap moment. And Love Connie, for those of you who don't know, is the queen in that scene who does the whole bend and snap bit and teaches her how to bend and snap. And, you know, we didn't talk about that with Love Connie, but Love Connie herself not only celebrates cult movies, but has been in movies that are cult movies and created a scene, which is one of the more cult moments in that movie.
Right, which you parodied. And let's face it, if you're in a movie that's parodied by Peaches Christ, you are cult.
I played the Jennifer Coolidge character in that show. And to talk about cult, my God, she sure is having her day in the sun.
I know. I think the gays have always known, but like the fact that her star continues to just ascend. Like I feel like every year Jennifer Coolidge gets more famous.
Well, we of course are ending the year with this episode, our final episode of the year. And one of the things that Michael and I wanted to bring to everyone's attention is that we've had to make a bit of a decision, and we hope that you understand where we're coming from. Michael and I, luckily, have become busy enough with our outside projects that actually pay the bills that we have found it a struggle to keep up with the content that we're creating with the Midnight Mass podcast on the schedule with which we were creating it. So the decision we had to make was, do we retire the podcast, which we did not want to do?
Absolutely
not. So no, we're not doing that. Or do we do episodes that are different, meaning that there's less of an episode, a shorter episode than what we're used to? And both Michael and I agreed that we really like what we've established. We really like the format. We enjoy digging deep. We know the podcast episodes are long. We like that. We're into it. So what we've decided is that we are now moving to a bi-weekly schedule as far as the output goes. So instead of releasing the episodes weekly, we're going to release them bi-weekly. And we hope that you'll understand that this is our attempt to keep this train on its tracks.
Yes.
And to keep delivering the content that we want to deliver and hopefully you want to listen to.
And if you're like me and you confuse bi-weekly and bi-monthly, we do, of course, mean that we're releasing episodes every other week instead of weekly, because I fuck that up all the time. I think that we do not want to interrupt what we're doing. We love the show. We love the way we do the show. And we value the conversations. If you get excited about our conversations about cult movies, I can assure you, so do we. We get lit up to talk about these things. And so we did not want to put the podcast in any situation where we compromise the joy that we put in and the joy that we take out. So rather than stop or change, we just are going to make sure that we give you what we've been doing, but we're spacing it out a little. Savor it.
Yeah. Michael and I hopefully will better be able to keep up with the schedule. But also, I think it just really allows us, it gives us more longevity. And the other thing I've learned from talking to listeners is a lot of the listeners do listen to these episodes in chunks. They don't necessarily listen to the entire thing at once. Yeah. So this is what we're going to do. Our Patreon is still where you can come and help support the podcast, and where we will continue to put out extra content, extra interviews. We'll continue to have private Zoom parties with our listeners. And we just finished, you know, this sort of epic project of putting together a Christmas calendar of Christmas cult genre films in an advent calendar form, where every day in the month leading up to Christmas, we presented a different movie. So if you still want to check out all of our content that we've ever put up, Midnight Mini Mass episodes where we talk about different movies that we haven't talked about on the main podcast, all that content is there and it's accessible to you if you want to sign up and join us over at the Patreon. And we will continue to put out content on the Patreon. So we just love that we get to do this. I know that Michael and I, it's no secret that neither he or I have made a single dime off this podcast. So when we say that it's a labor of love, you know, the Patreon certainly helps us pay our fabulous audio designer. But Michael and I really, we do love doing this. It is a labor of love. And we just thank you so much for tuning in and listening to it, because we get to talk about the Poseidon Adventure.
Absolutely.
And how much we fucking love it, you know? And it's a new year. It's a new 2023 is a new year. Michael and I commit to you that in 2023, we have a bunch of new episodes, some of which are already partially recorded. We have exciting stuff coming out. We love doing this. So we look forward to another year with you.
We truly do. And yes, listeners, thank you. Now, before we put this year to bed, Peaches.
Yeah.
I heard that you have one more tale of Christmas horror for us. I know Christmas is past, but, you know, we did spend 2 episodes of the main feed talking about holiday horror, and we did 25 days of holiday horror on our Patreon advent calendar. And then just today, despite the fact that Christmas, as of the time of this release, is over, you dropped a little bit of a Christmas bomb. And I'm like, okay, you got to tell us.
Every family has those stories that are kind of like, you know, family lore. And this is one of those stories that really happened to the Christ family back in the day. I was actually a young adult when this happened. It was in the early days of me not living at home, and I had come home to visit for Christmas, and my brother was in high school. I remember that. And it was my whole family, my sister, my brother, myself, my grandmother, her husband, my parents, who were still together at the time. And we went to church. It was Christmas Eve Mass. It wasn't midnight Mass. It was Christmas Eve Mass, though. And it was in downtown Annapolis, where I'd gone to high school, at St. Mary's Church, big old Catholic church, you know, that kind of like overly decorated old school church, right, with the castle behind the altar, you know, with the saints, you know, I mean, really kind of, it's a fabulous, epic, ancient old church in downtown Annapolis. We're there. It's Christmas Eve, and this woman, this old lady in front of us, sitting in the pew right in front of us, is coughing and coughing and coughing. And it is getting more and more violent, to the point where my mother is asking her husband, like, could I help? Could we get some help? The other thing to note is that my brother, who was the youngest at the time, was the one forced to sit in the pew next to them, right in front of us, because there wasn't enough room in our pew for the entire family to sit. So my brother was shoved up with this old lady and her husband.
She's like hacking away. Yeah,
she's hacking away, and then she is bending over, and like bile is coming out of her mouth and hitting the floor, you know, to the point where my mother is now saying, no, we need to do something. And the husband is begging my mother, you know, leave us alone. So my mother's waving to the priest, and there's probably like 600 people in the church, waving to the priest to stop his homily, you know, so that help can come. And essentially, you know, to make a long story short, she died. And what we think happened...
I'm not laughing because she died. I'm laughing because, oh my God. Like, you know,
she fucking died. And then, you know, it was this thing where we realized like that this was the plan, you know, this was the plan, was like, she's going to come. You could see that something was majorly wrong.
Wait,
with
you
her.
Think she knew she was going to die? So they came to church,
yes,
so she could drop
I
dead.
I think the husband. Yes. I think this was the plan. I think that she came to church sick. I mean, why was he rejecting our offers to help them? It was so weird, but she died. I mean, they brought in a whole fucking paramedics and, you know, stretcher and all that. Anyway, that's my story.
Well,
and, you know,
Gene Hackman's Jacob. Not going to lead you out of that.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's truly awful.
People wonder why I'm so fucked up and where Peaches Christ came from. Like, this is just all another day in the life of a crazy Catholic world.
Well,
anyway,
if you too have Catholic damage,
if you too get excited when you see the desecration on film of a Christmas tree, whether it be in the movie Female Trouble or the Poseidon Adventure, well, then you too might be one of the children of the popcorn now.
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.